Hello and welcome to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and Men's Magazines focuses on the arts. Culture, commentary, and in-depth news reporting is found in both the domestic and the international editions of GQ, Esquire, and Men's Health. In this edition, for the third week of December 2024, we will begin with part two of Happily Ever After, the Esquire love story of Colin Cook and Sidney Corcoran. He is a surfer and shark attack survivor. She, a survivor of the Boston Marathon bombing. They have overcome injuries, physical and psychic, to become one heck of a resilient, powerful, loving, and inspiring couple. Today, we will recap and return to their story before turning to Men's Health for more profiles in human courage, renaissance, and renewal. The Ultimate Men's Health Guys, the 10th anniversary edition. Before we begin, though, I must mention that Men's Magazines includes adult content and, on occasion, language which some might find offensive. Having said that, I encourage you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Men's Magazines. All right, as we begin our show today, I will remind us all that Happily Ever After traces the, at times harrowing, stories of the injuries and challenges endured by Colin Cook and Sidney Corcoran on the road to renewal and lasting love. Colin was a shy guy who struggled in school, had big surfing skills and pro surfing dreams, but struggled too to find the self-confidence necessary to pursue those dreams. He did move to Hawaii to take a job, live in a beach house, and pursue a laid-back day surfer's lifestyle, hitting the surf each morning, pursuing great wave breaks simply for the joy of it. In October of 2015, however, that joy gave way to terror as he lost a leg in a shark attack while surfing. Sidney found school easier than Colin till she was hit by a car at age 15 and nearly died. That accident led to years of physical therapy and rehab, punctuated by migraines so bad she could only attend school every other day. No sooner was she finding peace and healing after 3 years of hard work than she and her mother were caught up in and grievously injured by the Boston Marathon bombing. Down at the finish line to cheer on her aunt, who was running in the race, Sidney nearly lost her life for the second time. Sidney's mother, Celeste, lost a leg in the bombing and later traveled to Florida to be fitted with a cutting-edge prosthetic at Prosthetic and Orthotic Associates of Orlando. It was there that Celeste met Colin and his mother, Mary Beth, who had also come to town in search of a pain-free prosthetic leg. The two mothers became fast friends and laid the groundwork for Colin and Sidney to meet. Many months later, as Colin was working hard to adapt his walking prosthetic into one capable of allowing him to surf again, Colin and Sidney met at a fundraiser for 50 Legs, a nonprofit which raises money to help folks in need buy prosthetics. It wasn't love at first sight there at the fundraiser, but it was chemistry and a connection between two souls who had intimately understood the challenges, physical, mental, and emotional, the other had endured, and continued to endure. Friendship grew into romance in fits and starts. They each had injuries they were still very much contending with, including injured dreams and the sorting out of how to live and work and cope as they returned to work and day-to-day life in society. Today, we will return to their story as Colin, with Sidney's support, has found the courage to pursue his long-held dream of competitive surfing. Before we begin, I will remind you that if you missed part one last week and wish to hear it in its entirety, you can go to sunsounds.org online and listen to it as a podcast on demand. That said, let's return to our reading of Happily Ever After. The traffic was god-awful, and Sidney was so late to their first date that she and Colin had to wolf down their dinner. Colin could barely eat anyway because of his nerves, convinced he'd say something stupid. He kept excusing himself to the bathroom. Sure, he was about to puke. They barely talked, and then they went to a movie where they couldn't talk at all. The Huntsman, Winter's War, was somehow a sequel to Snow White and the Huntsman and was as bad as you'd imagine. Colin walked Sydney back to her Volvo SUV and didn't try to kiss her, didn't think he deserved to. He watched her drive away and got back on the highway to Rhode Island. His phone rang. Sydney. She asked if he was still in the parking lot. When he said no, she said that was too bad. If he were, she'd drive back and give him a kiss. They agreed to a second date, which led to more dates, and for Colin, a sense of unease that he'd somehow screw up a good thing. About a month into their relationship, his anxiety peaked when he drove to the Corcoran's place north of Boston near the New Hampshire border, where Sydney and her parents moved after the bombing. A large house that had been configured for the wheelchair Celeste used when the pain in her legs became unbearable. Colin tried to be lighthearted with Celeste and Kevin. Celeste still liked to call him Shark Boy, but in a moment when it was just Colin and Sydney in the living room, he turned to her. "What do you even see in me?" She blanched, unsure if he was serious. He went on. "Isn't it weird that I'm an amputee?" As in, how many amputees do you need in your life? My God, he was serious. "Look out that window," she said. He saw the green expanse of the front yard set a full acre back from the road on a bright summer day. "Look for all the fucks I give," Sydney said. Colin laughed, and she did too. She told him his experience didn't burden her. She liked it. She painted the fake toenails of her mother's prosthetics all the time. His life was one she understood. She'd been that close to death, too. Now she was here, with him. In the days ahead, Colin called and texted more playful in these messages with Sydney than he'd been with any other girl. Meanwhile, he and his buddies kept adjusting his surfing leg and foamed foot. One day, he told his dad he was heading out, too excited and nervous to say where. He went to the beach, and for the first time tested his surfing leg, out among Rhode Island's low and lolling waves. The knee buckled beneath him. The joint couldn't withstand his body weight and the water rushing against it. The foamed foot kept slipping off the board. The experiment didn't go well at all. As he swam back, something happened inside him, though, or rather failed to happen. No well of despair rose within him, as it once would have. Was this Sydney's influence? Some surge of trust she'd given him? He didn't know. He just redoubled his efforts back on shore. He and Pryor and Kramer's tightened the flexion of the knee joint, hoping that a more rigid knee would support him on the board. Days later, Colin made a second trek to the beach. The many months of fittings and adjustments to his surfing leg had been both frustrating and at times painful. His left limb was not fully desensitized, and Colin had to rest, recuperate, between strapping the leg on and trying again. On this new day, though, he felt like he was close to creating not only a prosthetic that no one else in the world had, but also something like a new self. He felt he was creating a new Colin. At the beach, he did the arduous work of attaching his surfing leg. He lifted his board and swam out. On the first big wave, he pushed up. And the foot stuck. He maneuvered on the board, pivoted, water crashed against him, and the knee held. The foamed foot absorbed water. He pivoted again and realized it. My God, I'm surfing. When he got back to land, Sydney was the first person he told. The more he surfed, the better he felt, until he reached a decision that shocked even him. I want to win competitions with my new leg. I want to turn pro. It was crazy. Colin Cook, competitive surfer, and yet that's what he wanted now and maybe always had. Maybe he'd always been unable to admit a desire to himself for fear of failing at it. To surf as a pro, though, meant that the puny waves of Rhode Island or Massachusetts wouldn't do. Hawaii was great, sure, but the rents. Sydney knew the story of Colin living in that walk-in closet, so Sydney and Colin decided to move to Southern California, where Colin had extended family, and Sydney's administrative job had an office, and work in the surfing industry, almost every pro needed a day job, was plentiful. Colin found a job designing surfboards in Oceanside, the beach town, an hour south of L.A. Sydney and Colin got a place near the water in Laguna Niguel, and bit by bit, their lives fell apart. It was the distance from Sydney's family. Her mother was her inspiration, and her brother her best friend. Her family, on both sides, had lived for generations in New England, and though Sydney had thought she would live elsewhere, she didn't feel nearly as poised and confident now as everyone had always assumed she was. She knew the truth. There was the bombing, and then the days, months, and, she should be honest, years when she relived it, when she felt uneasy in any new situation. The Vietnamese-American writer Viet Thanh Nguyen once wrote, "All wars are fought twice, the first time on the battlefield, the second time in memory." And Sydney knew it to be true. The war never ends with the war's end. In fact, she began to wonder in California if she had ever been poised and confident, because the dread had begun almost immediately after the bombing. Sure, she had projected strength for the Today Show and the Boston Globe, but she was also, mostly, a scared young woman who had nearly been killed in a car accident, and then found herself at the finish line of the Boston Marathon, and thought, as she recovered from this, her second near-death experience, "The universe doesn't want me here." Death was following her. She had been sure of it. When she and her mother had shared that hospital room, Sydney stared at what the bomb had taken from Celeste. What had Sydney done wrong in her life to do that to her mother? She thought this all the time. And then her thoughts turned suicidal. The part of Sydney that still wanted to live held fast to the one thing she could still control, what she ate. She would limit it at any meal, or just as often skip the meal entirely and work out like a fiend. The physical therapists who attended to her in Boston, the news camera crews that trailed her for follow-up stories, they all kept saying how committed she was to her rehab, walking and already regaining full mobility despite the massive stitching up and down and round her legs, tying her forever to that spring day on Boylston Street. What poise she had, they said. What resilience. What bullshit. The thoughts spun blacker in the weeks and months after the bombing, and so the workouts ran longer and the anorexia took a still stronger hold. And then the nightmares began. In one, the most vivid, Sydney crawled through a U.S. Army obstacle course, down in the mud, avoiding the barbed wire above, and then jumped to her feet and ran. All around her, she saw and heard explosions and gunfire, and now tracking her, gaining ground on her, mere feet from her, the Boston Marathon bombers, homemade explosives in their hands, and hatred in their eyes. She woke yelling and drenched in sweat. She tried therapy for the PTSD and anorexia. It helped, but the dark thoughts returned, or the nightmares did, or the desire to control it all did. She couldn't focus at Merrimack College and had to drop out. She met Colin Cook, and he offered an answer. After his attack, he said he was never scared of sharks. That astounded her. He even convinced Sydney about 6 months into their relationship to travel to Hawaii with him, return to the very waters that had taken his leg, and swim with the sharks there. She was so nervous that day, but Colin wasn't. With local shark experts guiding their swim, including Kayoni Beauthorpe, the guy who saved his life, Colin got in the ocean miles from the shores of Oahu and swam right next to the Galapagos and reef sharks. He let them swim around him. They were close enough to touch. Back on land, he shrugged it off. "The ocean is their home," he said. It amazed her, inspired her. He made her feel good, strong, especially when his own insecurities, like a searing self-doubt about making it as a surfer, rose up. Sydney, from the start, intuited how to buoy him and soothe him in the way that "look for all the fucks I give" had made him laugh at her parents' place and relaxed him. She felt useful around Colin. In other words, as the relationship deepened, she knew him better than he did. She felt loved, and this led her to love him all the more. She agreed then to create a new life in Laguna Niguel, but now in California, saw how war was indeed fought twice, and the uneasiness, the dread of new places and situations, they returned. She realized she had been able to help Colin only because of how well her mother and father and brother had helped her back in Massachusetts. In California, she felt malnourished again. Her homesickness wasn't a homesickness at all. It was the severing of an identity. It didn't matter how many times a day Sydney called home. Calling home 5 times a day made it worse. It didn't matter that their neighbors were friendlier than people on the prickly East Coast, or that their cozy 2-bedroom apartment in Laguna Niguel sat atop a hill whose sunsets from their window turned the whole neighborhood a soft and inviting gold. Sydney felt unmoored in California, leading an existence that was as quietly bleak as it had ever been after the bombing. What made it harder still was how Colin thrived out there. He had his job, California's big waves, an ever-expanding group of bros to surf with. With Sydney's encouragement, he'd found Paralympic-style surfing competitions and was about to unleash his new Colin on them, he said. The usefulness she offered no longer felt good. She cried every night, and most mornings, and a good chunk of each afternoon. Colin was at a loss. "Can you, like, try to be happy?" he asked. "I'm trying. I'm really trying." They never settled on a plan for their future. They continued to live their shared present, a loving and day-by-day improving present, but one where the past intruded for both of them. By 2019, Colin had competed in many adaptive surfing competitions and won the U.S. Nationals twice, but faltered both times at the World Championship in California. At Worlds, it was as if he were back in that cavernous hall in North Chelmsford, Massachusetts, meeting Sydney. The stage seemed too big, with too many other great surfers, too much searing self-doubt. The past's intrusiveness and the way Sydney and Colin could help each other focus on the here and now bound them, deepened their love. Sydney reminded Colin as he prepared for the 2020 Paralympic Championships, first a statewide competition, then nationals, then, if he qualified, Worlds, that he himself talked of how he wanted to be more than the victim of his attack. Winning Worlds would serve as evidence of a man who had not only bested that day, but moved beyond it. "You'll win when you can believe it," she told him. That was the problem, he said, his oldest of problems. There's no way I'm good enough for that, Colin thought. He took regionals, and then nationals again, and in mid-March 2020, in what would be the last days before COVID-19 shut everything down, Colin stepped onto the beach of the International Surfing Association's World Para Surfing Championships, held north of San Diego on the shores of La Jolla. A packed stretch of sand, 131 surfers from 22 countries. Colin paced the beach on the opening day of the five-day competition. He couldn't silence the voice that seared him and demanded perfection, but when he got in La Jolla's waters for his first heat at Worlds, the inner critic did what it had always done. Quieted enough so Colin could focus on winning the heat and advancing to the next round. It went like this for 4 days. Colin won and won. In fact, he performed so well in each heat, with the judges back on the shore grading him on the quality of the wave and how he rode it, that he was the favorite heading into the finals. On that morning, the fifth and last, he thought about how he shouldn't screw this up, but would anyway, because that's what he always did at Worlds. Sydney heard it. In the hotel room, on the beach, the self-talk that he mumbled before the previous two Worlds, and frankly, at so many points throughout their four-year relationship. I'm not sure I can do this. I'm not sure I want to. Why am I even here? She approached and looked deeply into his eyes. It stopped the talk and Colin's closed-loop pacing. You are a great surfer, she said. Do this for the love of surfing. Soon, the three finalists hit the water. Colin, Eric D'Argent of France, and Naomichi Katsukura of Japan. In the eyes of his loved ones, Mary Beth and Sydney holding hands on the beach, his dad watching the finals live stream from Rhode Island, Colin seemed to be the same Colin he'd always been. He waited and waited, letting the other finalists take waves, waiting for the perfect one that he alone could ride, demanding perfection from himself. But out on the water, what his loved ones couldn't see, what the surfing judges couldn't even score, was everything fading away. The competitors, the stress, the world narrowed until there was only Colin and the waves and Sydney's mantra. Do this for the love of surfing. He knew what she really meant. And now the perfect wave crested and he rode it. And then another perfect one. He rode that too. And when he reached the shore, the evidence from the judges was irrefutable. They married in April 2023 in a civil ceremony on the beach of Oahu's North Shore, she in a lace wedding gown and he in shorts and a Hawaiian floral shirt. Not just the location, but the date held significance, April being the month they met and 2023 being the 10th anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing, a day that ultimately led them to each other. Getting married 10 years later claims the date for ourselves, Sydney said. They live in Hawaii now, on Oahu, in a tiny rental on the North Shore, and when they talk about their experiences and how the way out of the paradox of life is love for someone greater than that for yourself, Sydney and Colin often look at each other and hold hands on their small couch. It was a risk, moving still farther west from Lowell, but Sydney has found here what Colin has always cherished. On their afternoon hikes to the top of one of Oahu's lush mountain peaks, taking in the Pacific, or on their morning walks for coffee and sandals, Sydney likes the island's slow-down life that dwells on the moment before them, which they've learned is all they really have. She's better. The dread and, in particular, the severing of self are things of her past. She's also taken the advice she gives Colin. She ignores the fear that rises when pursuing the life she wants. Her journal entries have morphed into writing she's looking to publish. She's quit her 9-to-5. She never liked the corporate life. To make candles, she ships to an ever-burgeoning list of mainland clients. Surfing was an Olympic competition in this year's Summer Games, and adaptive surfers could compete in future Paralympics. Colin is looking toward a future in which he might be Colin Cook, Olympian. Even he laughs at how big his dreams have become. Sydney still shapes them. She has to. Colin wakes in the morning now wanting to surf, but is sometimes terrified a shark will bite him. The wars return. Something about actually moving out here, something about Hawaii being permanent now, has also reanimated for Colin how the sharks never left either. The PTSD took 6 years to surface, and these days, on the worst days, it keeps him from riding the waves. The only thing that saves him is Sydney. When his panic is a physical pain in his chest, she guides him to the beach. She watches while he latches on his surfer's leg. Most days, she says nothing. And then he breathes out, and after a nod from her, tiptoes his way into the water. Just knowing she's back there, he'll later say, but not be able to finish for how much her presence on shore means to him in the water. By the time the first wave hits, he's fine. New Colin. He surfs. He improves. When he comes in, she's still there, and the two of them, holding hands, walk home. And that concludes Happily Ever After by Paul Kix, published in Esquire. We are on now to men's health, and just as a little orientation, Men's Health has been publishing for 10 years now an annual piece on men who are athletes and entrepreneurs and survivors of great challenges. And so they create a top 10 list of ultimate men's health guys. Here's how they state it. For a decade, we've searched the nation for men we admire. Men who are physically strong, yes, but also mentally resilient, socially connected, and all-around good guys. This year's finalists embody all of that. Our all-star judging panel made sure. The Ultimate Men's Health Guy by Noah Galloway. Before we begin Mr. Galloway's preamble to the top 10, we must pause here for station identification. You're listening to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. And now back to Men's Health and the ultimate top 10 guys for 2024. What ultimate means to me. For as long as I can remember, being a part of Men's Health was a dream of mine. When I became the first Ultimate Men's Health Guy in 2014, it wasn't just recognition of my battles, but fulfillment of that dream. The journey that led me there wasn't easy. After losing an arm and a leg during combat in Iraq, I had to rediscover my love for fitness and how to challenge my body. Winning allowed me to share my story and connect with others who were fighting their own battles. I heard from so many others like me. Vets, amputees, people who have faced struggles and have overcome them or wanted to know how. Winning the title gave me the courage to keep sharing as a personal trainer, as a public speaker, and through the No Excuses Charitable Fund I helped launch. Now, as we celebrate 10 years of the Ultimate Men's Health Guy Contest, I'm honored to be part of this legacy, passing the torch to a new generation of men who have made mental health a core part of who they are, something many of us guys found tough to talk about 10 years ago. This year's finalists, Ryan Lennon, Aaron Sanchez, and Hassan Page, have demonstrated incredible strength, both physically and mentally. Lennon dedicates his life to helping others as a licensed clinical social worker in the U.S. Navy. Sanchez lives with stage 4 cirrhosis and leverages his sobriety to inspire. Page, a heart attack survivor, rebuilt his life through fitness, meditation, art, and a focus on staying present. These men prove that the spirit of the ultimate men's health guy is thriving in 2024 and beyond. Now, Noah Galloway just gave a shout out to the top three, but there's 10, so we're going to start with 10, number 10, and work our way up. Our ultimate top 10. With all the awesome men who entered this year's competition, judging was heated. These guys rounded out our top 10 by living incredible, motivational lives. Number 10, Jordan Pollock, 32, entrepreneur and photographer, Texas. Pollock transitioned in 2016 and has built a new body through lifting, running, skating, wakeboarding, and snowboarding. Twice a week, I do contrast therapy to help me relax and de-stress after a long day or week, he says. And his friends help him wind down, too. I'm a very social person, he says. I love connecting with other transgender individuals through social media, as that has been amazing, meeting others who understand me. Number 9, Dwayne Arrett, Jr., DPM, 40, podiatrist, Ohio. In addition to his work as a clinician, Arrett is an associate professor at Kent State University, a Naval Reserve officer, and a dad. On top of all that, he's always looking for a way to challenge his fitness through a triathlon, trail race, or fitness test. How does he do it? By getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep, setting aside personal time, and planning. One small thing I do every day is wake up early enough to have an undisturbed cup of black coffee. It helps me prepare. Making a plan, schedule, and being disciplined also really helps me stay organized and on top of priorities. Number 8. Carlvin Dorvillier, 33, Google Business Lead, New Jersey. Dorvillier says his strength comes from not letting his past define him. Overcoming the loss of my mother and financial hardship at a young age, I forged my own path. Now he's at Google as an agency business lead and co-captains its internal organization for black employees. To handle stress, he prioritizes exercise, but also a mindful day-starting routine and journaling on Talkspace. My journey has taught me that true manhood is not about machismo, but about empathy, vulnerability, and defying societal expectations, he says. Number 7, Nelson Candelario, 43, attorney, California. Candelario has been in the U.S. Marine Corps for 20 years and provides pro bono legal advice to veterans. He volunteers as an instructor of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, a sport that he practices 4 to 6 times a week. How he stays grounded. My family is central, and I prioritize quality time with them through activities like yoga with my wife and jiu-jitsu with my 2 young boys. Number 6, Christopher Borgsteed, 60, retired canine police officer, Idaho. Borgsteed knows tragedy. Injuries after hitting a deer at 60 miles per hour on his motorcycle. Surviving Whipple surgery to stave off pancreatic cancer. Losing his ex-spouse to suicide. Learning to lean on loved ones and faith in God was crucial, says Gina Dotto, Borgsteed's wife, who submitted his application. Chris manifests what he wants to create in his life from a place of gratitude. Number 5, Michael Twining, 56, agricultural sales and marketing VP, Delaware. When Twining turned 50, he says he was in the worst shape of his life and thought mental health was taboo. I had gotten used to letting life happen, rather than making life happen, he says. Today, I feel like I'm just beginning to live. Now the former Army officer exercises every day, cooks healthy, volunteers with a school in Uganda, and decompresses with his two rescue dogs. Number 4. Chris Rudin, 34, professional speaker and author, Florida. Born with two fingers on his left hand, Rudin hid his birth defect for 17 years. Through fitness, he found confidence and the will to step forward into work as an advocate for disability inclusion. I constantly do introspective check-ins with myself to manage the mental burnout that comes with life and a chronic illness. At 19, he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, which he manages through a healthy diet and powerlifting. Number 3. King Comeback. A near-death experience followed by depression pushed Hassan Page to reevaluate everything, by John Vircher. Hassan Page, a 54-year-old behavioral data analyst, was 12 when his father discovered that an employee at their family deli in Philadelphia had been stealing from them. One of the guys from the neighborhood that was a customer, Page says, said to my father, "Mr. Page, you're not upset? If that was me, I would have done this, that, and the other thing to them if they stole from me." And I remember what my father said like it was yesterday. He said, "What am I going to get upset about? It already happened. I can't change that. The best thing I can do now is to figure out how it's not going to happen to me again." These sage words would prove prophetic for Page in 2019 when he suffered a heart attack. "I was in my basement home gym, working out like any other day. In the middle of a set of bench presses, I felt a tightening in my chest. I've been working out long enough to know that this didn't feel like the normal exertion I feel. Still, I tried to work through it, but it progressively intensified to the point where I couldn't make it up the second flight of stairs to our bedroom. My wife, thankfully, was at the top of the stairs, and she could tell immediately that something was wrong." Something was very wrong. Page suffered a widowmaker heart attack in which the largest artery in the heart, responsible for carrying 50% of the blood supply to your cardiac muscles, is blocked. Page's wife called an ambulance. Paramedics arrived and performed life-saving measures at his home and during the ride to the ER. Throughout the process, he was declared clinically dead twice. The next thing I knew, I woke up in a hospital bed. 8 hours had passed. My wife was there. My father was there. Doctors had placed 2 stents in his mid-left anterior descending artery. Page had survived the near unsurvivable, the docs said, because he was lucky. But he didn't feel that way. And soon, depression set in. "I've been working out regularly since I was 30 years old. I'm disciplined in my diet. I don't smoke. Even at the family cookouts, I was mindful of what I ate. I was doing everything I was supposed to do." Adding to Page's cognitive dissonance was a post-surgery stint in cardiac rehab, a necessary intervention if he was to prevent another heart attack, let alone return to regular exercise. "While I was glad to be alive, it was hard to be around people decades older than me with the same or similar conditions. Not to disparage anyone there. I called the place Heaven's Waiting Room to myself," he says. "Not only could I not figure out how this had happened to me, but I felt like I had somehow let my wife and son down. I found myself keeping them at arm's length because I had rationalized that if this is going to happen again, I wanted it to be less difficult for them if they had to let me go." But Page was his father's son, and those words from him when he was young echoed louder and louder in his ears. "The best thing I can do now is figure out how it's not going to happen to me again." Although Page has never subscribed to a particular faith, he was raised in a religious household, and spirituality did speak to him. Remembering his father's words led him to Buddhism's philosophies, particularly those about being present, and the phrase, "In order to die well, one must live well." Once Page began practicing Buddhism regularly, he went back to his home gym, what he calls returning to the scene of the crime. But he's not just hoisting plates anymore. He's added yoga once a week as a means of active meditation. He takes 5 medications daily to manage his blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol, and he sees his cardiologist every 6 months. To clear his head, he takes his older dog, along with a recent younger rescue, with a heart condition and daily medications of its own, on walks near their home. And in the process, he discovered a nature trail nearby. After bringing the dogs back, he takes walks on this trail alone, listening to the rustle of the leaves and branches above, feeling the dirt and rocks shift beneath his feet, and finding bird feathers and deer tracks on his path. "My heart attack occurred on October 28, 2019, Page says. If you know anything about numerology, those numbers add up to 111, a number that equates to some as rebirth, while others see it as a signal from the universe that it's time to embark on a new chapter in life. In many ways, Page has experienced a rebirth. He reprioritized what's important in his life and has become more present than ever through Buddhism. He's restored the close-knit nature of his family life. He's even returned to creating art with pastel chalk, an activity that brings him great joy and peace. Page lives each day as though it may be his last, and he endeavors to spread that message to others, to be a guide. Number 2, Mr. Reinvention. After a gut punch of a diagnosis, Aaron Sanchez faced a stark choice. So he cleaned up and retooled his entire life. By Daniel Gonzalez. Aaron Sanchez was dreading an appointment with the doctor. After 20 years of drinking a fifth of vodka a day, he knew the news wouldn't be good. A peek online at his blood work earlier that day had already confirmed his biggest fear, cirrhosis of the liver. Now he was about to find out just how severely he'd destroyed the organ, which was so enlarged and calcified it protruded from his abdomen. For support, Sanchez brought along his then-fiancée, now-wife, Carrie Steele. The doctor gave it to Sanchez straight. "One more drop, you're dead." Confused, Sanchez asked what that meant. "Cut back?" The doctor looked Sanchez right in the eyes and repeated, "One more drop, you're dead." And that was November 11th, 2022. Sanchez hasn't had a drop of alcohol since. The 43-year-old pipe fitter from suburban Phoenix now recites his sobriety data as easily as his birthday, 11/11. But the early stages were rough. Sanchez didn't work for a month, dealing with restless sleep and other physical effects of alcohol withdrawal. He became even more despondent when a further diagnosis from a liver specialist showed that his cirrhosis was stage 4, the type that's irreversible even with medication. Sanchez also learned he was type 2 diabetic. He barely ate. Motivation was scarce until he realized where he needed to look. Sanchez has a 16-year-old son, Aaron Jr., from a previous relationship, and Sanchez and Steele share a 5-year-old son, Aiden, who has periventricular nodular heterotopia, or PVNH, a rare brain malformation that occurs prior to birth and is incurable. Incurable just like stage 4 liver cirrhosis. This hit Sanchez one day when he was seated on the sofa in his living room, suffering from withdrawal. Steele and Aiden had gone out for ice cream. I just wanted to wither away, Sanchez recalls. As an alcoholic, you think you're missing out on the fun when you're not drinking, but you don't realize you're actually missing out on life. Sanchez has long considered Aiden a miracle. Most males with PVNH die before birth or shortly after. Realizing that addiction had prevented him from truly being with his sons became his fuel for change. The first thing Sanchez did was call his boss and get back to work. He also hit the gym. He hasn't stopped exercising since. Sanchez had always worked out on and off, even when he was drinking, but at 6'1", he had ballooned to more than 300 pounds with a size 40 waist. So he started working out 3 times a week with resistance bands. Then he eased into weights, knowing his cirrhosis and high blood pressure could trigger a stroke that could kill him. And now he lifts weights for 90 minutes 6 or 7 times a week. Sanchez gets most of his cardio walking on the job. He works 6 10-hour days a week as a union pipe fitter for UA Local 469 out of Phoenix. On a typical day, he logs 18,000 to 20,000 steps on his Fitbit. Besides doing all that walking, Sanchez plays basketball with friends. Diet-wise, Sanchez now fuels up before and after workouts on plant-based organic protein powders, plus greens, zero-sugar Greek yogurt, and lots of grilled chicken and rice, a nod to his Mexican heritage. To keep his blood sugar in check, he doesn't eat sweets, though he's a fan of Lenny and Larry's high-protein cookies. He's given up red meat, except for the occasional steak on date nights with Steele. He takes medications to help process what his liver can't and prevent foggy brain, a condition caused by a buildup of ammonia from diminished liver function. Sanchez has shed 95 pounds. He's down to a 31-inch waist. However, stage 4 cirrhosis of the liver can be a death sentence without a liver transplant. Doctors can't tell Sanchez how long he has, but during a recent visit, his physician took off his glasses, closed his laptop, and, based on the encouraging results of his blood work, said, according to Sanchez, "I don't know how you did it, but keep doing what you're doing." Sanchez plans to, because while the health benefits have been amazing, they still can't match his newfound ability to be fully present for his sons. The highlight of Sanchez's day, he says, is snuggling with Aiden at bedtime and reading him a book. It's peace. It's powerful. It's pure motivation. And now the ultimate men's health guy. Number 1. The champion. Ryan Lennon is combining his master's degree in social work with his naval combat experience to serve sailors in need. By Brian Smith. Growing up in Detroit under a rough, gruff, blue-collar, beat cop, short-fused, heel-clack, ramrod-straight code, Ryan Lennon knew his marching orders. Feeling sad? Swallow it. Angry? Channel it. Johnny took your G.I. Joe? Get it back. Leave the couch moaning kumbaya touchy-feely crap to the civilian suckers willing to pay $200 an hour. So what does Lennon do? He becomes the psych boss for the U.S. Navy. A shrink. A therapist. I know, Lennon says, chuckling. Okay, he took on the psych boss role after a few years as a combat engineer. After he made a name for himself playing rugby, turned his carved arms into tattoo sleeves, and most recently landed an assignment at Camp Pendleton near San Diego, overseeing the mental health of the legendary 1st Marine Division. Still, how does this happen to someone raised in a family with men awash in testosterone who look at talk therapy with about as much respect as they would a guy who doesn't light a lady's cigarette? Lennon isn't 100% certain himself, but one thing is clear. He's the perfect guy for the job. I met Lennon at a Starbucks down the road from the Great Lakes Naval Station, which lies about 40 miles north of Chicago and is the Navy's largest training installation and only boot camp facility. We would have met at his house, but he's in the process of moving to Camp Pendleton to start his stint with the Marines, so his place, he says sheepishly, is a wreck. He had also planned to come in uniform, but had a change of heart at the last minute. He didn't want to make me uncomfortable, empathy, or feel any eyes on him. It didn't work. At 39 years old, Lennon has a commanding presence. He's swole, and there's the ink that crawls up and down his arms, the buzz cut, the square jaw, the sturdy handshake grip, the direct gaze, and low-key swagger. He works out a lot, weights and cardio daily, rugby 3 or 4 days a week during the season, yoga just as often. He has an open, friendly face and a disarming manner that reads as instantly likable. Lennon grew up in Ferndale, Michigan, an inner-ring suburb of Detroit. His father, who died in 2021, was an Irish Catholic beat cop, powered by the heart of a drill sergeant. He was a smoker and a drinker and just a hard-edged guy his entire life. What softness there was came from his mother, a stay-at-home mom. Early on, Lennon followed the path you might expect. He played sports. He became a leader. At Grand Valley State University, outside Grand Rapids, he discovered rugby, a passion that hasn't faded. It's been a mainstay in my life and a source of socialization, a good outlet for me physically, but socially as well. I try to harp on the benefits of finding something like that in life. It doesn't have to be rugby, but you've got to find something. While still an undergrad, Lennon spoke with an educational counselor and decided to earn his master's degree in social work at Grand Valley State. Then, as a sort of compromise with his tough guy upbringing, he joined the Navy at age 27. He spent the first 4 years as a combat engineer, a fancy title for advanced troops who rapid build bridges and forward operating bases, sometimes under fire. We carried a hammer in one hand and a rifle in the other, he says. He loved the action, but he was also thinking about the future. Combat engineering is a young man's game, and he was already over 30. Well, then I found out that after a few years that the Navy actually uses people who have social work degrees and people with backgrounds in mental health. So I just put in a package and got picked up to be a therapist, which is a pretty stark career change. Eventually, he found himself aboard the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower as a counselor in a combat zone for an onboard 5,000-strong crew of male and female sailors and officers. Homesickness was the biggest issue brought to him, especially with first-time deployments. Anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, suicidal thoughts. When you get deployed, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, this is the real deal. It really sinks in. I'm in the military now. You're being ordered around. You're working 18 hours a day and not sleeping well because you're on a big old rusty ship. Military data shows that the suicide rate among active duty service members is 77% higher than the general U.S. populations, a point punctuated by stark reports about a series of suicides on the USS George Washington last year. Lennon sees it. You've got those guys on the ship that have been deployed 3 times on the ice in the last 3 years, and they did a COVID cruise where they had no port of calls, wearing masks all the time. They're on the same shift for 3 years, and they're just burned out. Yet, the deeper he got into the job, the more Lennon discovered about himself. For starters, he was good at it. His experience in combat zones and his upbringing gave him cred among the crew. His education gave him an academic framework. But most key was what he found within himself. Empathy, perceptiveness, even sensitivity. Those who came to him were comfortable enough to open up despite their own misgivings, to say nothing of the stigma attached to therapy in the military. "I know what they're saying without them saying it," Lennon says. "Hey, if you told me that you smoked weed on leave, I don't give a shit. Whatever, it doesn't matter to me. Let's get to the heart of what's going on with you. Let's figure this shit out. You don't need to feel like you're talking to the police." He also learned to cut to the chase. His type of therapy doesn't involve years of psychoanalysis. With so many people seeking counsel, we need to be as impactful as we can in 2 or 3 sessions. So, we try to get to the crux of the matter quickly. His one rule springs directly from his upbringing. No whining. Venting, yes, but whining, no. The difference: people venting are looking for solutions. People whining just want to dump and moan. Echoes of his family upbringing, he says. Which raised a question I had all through my interview with Lennon. What did his tough guy father think of his son earning a living talking to men about their feelings? "I don't think he understood it," Lennon says. "But his dad supported him. He enjoyed the fact that I was making a good career out of it." Lennon has certainly done that. After 3 years of working in a hospital at the Great Lakes Naval Station, he secured an assignment with one of the premier divisions in all the military, the 1st Marine Division. Hospitals need to be staffed, he acknowledges, but for therapists like him, men of action with combat training and experience, they need to get us out to the ships and to the submarines and with the expeditionary folks, with the Marines. That's where we should go. And that's where we're going. Definitely where he's going. Full speed ahead. Another hour has blown past here at Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and I have very much enjoyed reading these articles to you, many of them quite moving. The love of Colin and Sydney. The exceptional comeback stories of the 10 men featured in Men's Health. So many obstacles, so much fortitude, suffering, and people finding faith again in themselves, in higher powers, in their family, in what they're meant to be doing in the world. Between now and next week, the Christmas season, the holiday season is coming on fast. I wish you well in your preparations. And as you're out there scurrying around, no matter what you're celebrating this season, take care of yourself. Take care of one another. Peace.